I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network, and David McCullough is with us this hour. He has a book now that's really a collection of just some of the speeches, wonderful speeches that he's given over the past 25 years. The book is The American Spirit, and it is subtitled The American Spirit, Who We Are and What We Stand For. David is the most honored historian in the country. He has won 2 Pulitzer Prizes for the book Truman and John Adams, both terrific books, 2 National Book Awards, and the Presidential Medal of Freedom Award. Other well-known books, The Wright Brothers, 1776, The Path Between the Seas, and Mornings on Horseback. He's given many important speeches before Congress, the White House, colleges and universities, historical institutions, people who are about to become citizens of the United States. That would be a great speech to be giving. And of course, it's laced, this book, with words about people in history because he finds them fascinating and thinks we all should. Thomas Jefferson, important but forgotten people in Congress, John F. Kennedy, John Adams, John Quincy Adams, Benjamin Franklin, Harry Truman, FDR, etc., etc. And we're going to talk to him about history and some of these speeches and some of the greats that we remember and those we should remember. Our phone number for you to speak with David McCullough is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Twitter is @KDunnShow. And David, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you, and thank you for that very generous description of my new book. I appreciate that very much.
I really enjoyed it. I watched it with my old dog at my feet in the living room, and it was just, you inspired me. We can be a little rattled by all that's going on these days, but I was steeped in history with you, and you made me want to investigate so many people I haven't thought very much about, and also, the book gives this spirit of hope that who we have been and who we are, we're a pretty amazing country.
Well, I think that our story is a source of inspiration, and it's also, of course, a great lesson in life. That's what history is about. It's not about dull lessons we have to read at night, not about statistics and memorizing dates and quotations and so forth. It's about human beings. History is human.
Mm-hmm.
And Jefferson said, when in the course of human events, and the operative word there is human. And as the story of our past is filled with great people and great accomplishments and great idealistic aspirations, all noble and memorable, it's also filled with scoundrels and blabbermouths and crooks. And,
right.
And the whole reach of both on the dark side and on the glorious side of the human story, the human nature.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I love it. And I think anyone who gets hooked on it will quickly realize that there's more to be learned from history than any other subject.
I'm with you. I love it.
It's all there. It's not just politics and war. It's about art and music and philosophy and science and medicine. And
mm-hmm.
It's the whole reach of the human attainments.
I really have found myself, my favorite person to read about is Abraham Lincoln, but I've found myself really drawn, and I'm so glad that John Quincy Adams finds his way into your book frequently, and I love what you remind us of, that John Adams told his wife Abigail, that boy should read history, when he was talking about John Quincy Adams.
That's right.
Did he ever read history? Didn't he? Hoo-wee.
Yes, and we all should read history, and we all should have our boys and girls, our grandchildren and our children read history. And we should all, best of all, take them to historic places. There's nothing that can light the spark of interest in history that can last a whole lifetime. I remember going to Monticello when I was 15, and I just was swept away by what Jefferson did and all of his interests and all of his scientific equipment and so forth. And that's where it began. I know for sure. That's where my interest, my love of history began, because of that trip.
And then you got to go and give a speech to people who were being naturalized. What a moment that must have been for you.
Yes, at that same place.
Oh.
And I really love immigrants. I love new Americans, because that's our story. We're all immigrants, mm-hmm. whether we arrived yesterday or whether we arrived 200 years ago. We've all come from somewhere else, except the Native Americans, of course, but we've all come from somewhere else, and we're a blend, we're a mix, we're an amalgam, and that's our strength. When you think of the people of talent and accomplishment and who about whom we have rightful pride, who came here from somewhere else. I love to remind people that, our capital city, Washington, was laid out by an immigrant, a Frenchman.
Mm-hmm.
That our capital building was designed by an immigrant. And then you think of immigrants like Irving Berlin, let's say.
Sure.
God Bless America was written by an immigrant.
Hmm.
And on and on. And so let us hope it shall always be.
Absolutely. Let's go back to Thomas Jefferson for a moment, because in one of the speeches, I kind of weave them all together here, they're all in my head, you talk about what an extraordinary thing it was, and he was the guy who was the writer, but here he is writing the Declaration of Independence, and he's a man of books, but all of it's in him. He's just sitting there writing. It's all in his head. It's in his heart.
Right. Now, if you or I were assigned to write the Declaration of Independence,
right. No, thank
you. We would bring trunkfuls of books to look into for inspiration or quotations or something. He had nothing but his little writing stand that he'd made, and his pen, and his head, of course. And the man was a genius. There's no question about it. And he was a classic 18th century polymath. In other words, somebody who's interested in everything. If he'd only been an architect, he would be one of them. He would be a major historic figure in our country.
Hmm.
And yet he was so many other things as well. I've had my greatest sense of accomplishment in writing about people who were lesser known than Jefferson or Franklin Roosevelt. I wanted to write about John Adams or Harry Truman,
mm-hmm.
because I felt that they deserved more of the limelight, deserved more credit and appreciation than they've had until I started working on my biographies. And I feel that each of those two men is an example of the best that's in us.
Hmm.
In the case of each, they both came from very modest backgrounds. Adam's mother was almost certainly illiterate. His father probably could read enough to read the Bible. The Bible was the only book in the house.
Hmm.
Harry Truman, mother and father were people of very modest means, farmers, and Harry Truman spent a good part of his youth on a farm, struggling on a farm to mm-hmm. make a go of it. He never had the chance to go to college, and yet he never stopped reading, read history all his life.
Hmm.
Harry Truman was a much more interesting and interested man than it was understood at the time when he was president. He would go to the National Symphony, for example, because he loved classical music, not for a photo opportunity or anything like that. And if they were playing someone he really cared about, like Mozart, he'd take the score with him. yeah, right. And he read constantly, mostly history. And he had that wonderful line. He said, "The only thing new in the world is the history you don't know."
Mm-hmm.
And I remember fondly that when George Marshall was, after Truman had appointed General George C. Marshall Secretary of State, Marshall was asked at a press conference if he'd had a good education at the Virginia Military Institute. And he said, "No, I didn't." And they said, "Well, why not, sir?" He said, "Because we had no history."
Oh.
And I think a leader needs to know history, whether it's political leader, military leader, business leader, whatever it is. whatever form of leadership, because that's where you find out cause and effect. It's where you find out what determination, perseverance, and good spirit can accomplish.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always felt that the best life is the life of accomplishment, making something, building something, improving something. I spent a good while recently working on my book about the Wright brothers, and and they were raised by their father and mother to have purpose in life.
Mm-hmm.
And boy, did they ever. And the father would tell them that's where real happiness is. It's not in having a lot of possessions or a lot of money or taking long vacations. It's accomplishing something. Accomplishing something of value in your lifetime, be it large or small.
Yeah, well, we'll pause for a moment and get a drink of water and return. David McCullough is our guest this hour. He has a new book, and it's a collection of 25 of the speeches he's given over the last 25 years. They're at commencement addresses. They're for people who are being naturalized. They're before joint sessions of Congress, 50th anniversary of the assassination of John Fitzgerald Kennedy. He gave a speech in Dealey Plaza. The book is The American Spirit, Who We Are and What We Stand For, and because he's America's best known and most decorated, really, historian. There is all kinds of history in each one of these speeches. It's filled with that and a great read. Our phone number, if you would like to join the conversation with Mr. McCullough, is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We are on Twitter, and that is at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network. David McCullough is with us this hour. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, and we'll put your phone calls into the conversation as they come in. Let's go to John in Milwaukee first. Hi, John.
Hi. I'd like to ask Mr. McCullough if he is... Has read the books of Gore Vidal, or seen his interviews on C-SPAN, and what he thinks of his sort of cynical history. And one other question is private central bank that was opposed by many people was signed by Washington and proposed by Hamilton, but opposed by Jefferson, Franklin, and Jackson, and was finally gotten rid of until the Federal Reserve Bank. So the history of the bank and Gore Vidal.
Gore Vidal. All right, David.
Well, you're asking me good questions about two subjects about which I don't know much about, and I always believe it's best to talk about what you know and not try to skim along on the surface above something that you don't know much about. I have read some of Gore Vidal's novels, and I enjoyed them, but I took them to be novels.
Mm-hmm.
And I took his talent to be winsome and stylish, and as a writer, I applauded him. About the banks, I know very little, and I still know very little about banks. My wife is the Secretary of the Treasury in our family. So I have to pass on that one.
And my husband is in our family. Let me tell you, I just should have learned about that in life and never have and probably never will. Let's talk about some people who you think we should know more about. And you had this really good, I think you gave it before, a joint session of Congress in which you talked about all the greats who were in the House and who were in the Senate, and how we, you know, maybe have a whole lot of biographies of Joseph McCarthy, but where's Margaret Chase Smith? Where are some of the people who were there during these very important times in American history, huge figures in our country, and yet they're forgotten?
Well, they shouldn't be, and that's why I encourage young people who are interested in a life in publishing or writing or scholarship to take up these wonderful subjects that are sitting there waiting to be done. Margaret Chase Smith was a woman of infinite character and strength of character, and somebody whom I admire enormously. And for those who may be listening that don't know who she was, she stood up on the floor of the United States Senate at a time to oppose Senator Joe McCarthy, who was riding high and was casting fear in the hearts of most everybody with his attacks and his voluminous abuse of other people because they were opposing him. And she stood up with a backbone that is always admirable under such a situation. And she said, "I speak as a Republican. I speak as a woman. I speak as a United States Senator. I speak as an American. I don't want to see the Republican Party ride to political victory on the four horsemen of calumny, fear, ignorance, bigotry, and smear." That should be something none of us ever forget. Just as I dearly honor and love to remind people of the line from a letter that John Adams wrote to Abigail the very night that he first occupied the White House, and she was still back home in Massachusetts, a line that Franklin Roosevelt first had carved into the wooden fireplace in the state dining room in the White House, and that Kennedy later had carved into the marble part of the fireplace mantelpiece. And he said, "May none but honest and wise men ever rule under this roof." And I think what's so admirable there is that he put honest first. May none but honest and wise men. I feel as far as people that we need to know more about, I would put first, right at the head of the line, Dr. Benjamin Rush.
Benjamin Rush, yeah, it's fascinating.
Absolutely extraordinary man who was involved in everything. He was the youngest to sign the Declaration of Independence. He's only 30 years old. Mm-hmm. And we remember so many of these founding fathers as in their older lives, in their last years, when they were white-haired gentlemen of state, and to be greatly honored. But at the time when the die was being cast, at the time of the Revolution, they were young. Imagine Jefferson was only 33 when he wrote the Declaration of Independence.
Remarkable.
Washington took command when he was 44.
Mm-hmm.
But Benjamin Rush had the he was a doctor, and he was way ahead of his time. In many ways, from our point of view, it would seem backward in time, but as a doctor. But he was the first to argue that the mentally ill, the insane, should be treated as human beings, not just locked up in a cell for the rest of their lives. To treat them kindly and with consideration, and to make sure that they got the right things to eat and were clean and the rest. And this was radical. He was one of the first to be an ardent opponent of slavery. He was brave in the extreme during epidemics of smallpox or yellow fever, and would go in where this was happening at tremendous risk to his own life. And he helped establish the Dickinson School. He wanted to introduce modern Romance languages, French in particular, into the curriculum of colleges, which was absolutely unheard of at the time.
Mm-hmm.
He just was a marvelous, productive, brilliant, good-hearted man of that time. And he's the one who got Adams and Jefferson to reconcile, to go back to being friends again, to come out of their anger and come out of their isolation and make contact with each other. And of course, as you know, Jefferson and Adams then commenced one of the greatest exchanges of letters ever among men of consequence, for the rest of their lives.
Yeah. So why do we forget somebody? That is a fascinating story about Benjamin Rush. And why is it that we forget him? Why no huge, major, well-known biography of Margaret Chase Smith? How do we miss these important people in our past?
Well, I think there's a tendency, as there is in the present day, to put all the limelight, all the spotlights, and the flurries of music in tribute to the celebrities.
Right.
And we have our historic celebrities no less than we have our present-day celebrities. And that's fine if those celebrities are deserving of our attention, which most of them are. But there are others who also are greatly deserving our attention. And that's why there's great opportunity for historians, biographers, writers of all kinds, to explore these lives. That's really been my experience as a writer from the time I first got going.
Hmm. Just think of what you've done for John Adams. I mean,
well,
that great book, and then that series. That series was marvelous. It was so good.
Well, people ask me a lot how I felt about the series. I thought it was terrific.
I did, too.
And then they'll say, well, they left a lot out. Well, of course they left a lot out. It would be like saying that the piano player was a great piano player, but he didn't sound as good as the violin player. It's two different means of communication. And I have never worked with better people in my life than the people that produced that series. The people that did the costumes, the props, the sets, everything was done exactly to perfection. If they wanted some sort of a prop that they couldn't find in its original form, they'd have somebody make one exactly as it should be. And when I first met with Tom Hanks about doing it, I said there are only two things that I really will insist on. And he's asked what they were. And I said, first of all, that it isn't a costume pageant, that you show that people suffered, that there people were missing teeth and had injured arms or dirty clothes or so forth. And that some of these customs of the time were, in fact, ugly and unkind. Like tar and feathering someone. That was a form of torture. And the second one was that he didn't violate the language of the time. He didn't have these characters of the 18th century giving throwaway lines from the present day. That, okay, John, you be the good cop and I'll be the bad cop, that sort of thing. And the fact that the lead roles were played by Frank Berlotti.
Jeremiah, what's his name?
Frank.
Paul Giamatti.
Laura Linney and Frank.
Giamatti?
Oh, Giamatti, thank
Giamatti.
You.
Yeah,
they were played by. Were trained as classical actors.
Right.
The language didn't bother them in the slightest, and we never had a single complaint about it that I know of.
Hmm. And that.
And I think that that great documentaries, great dramatizations of that kind, are of infinite value to spread the reality of our past and our story. I feel very strongly it's not just a question of being informed or educated about our past. That's called for is to be made aware of how much we owe those people.
We sure
and
do.
If you're in ignorance of it, isn't just ignorant. It's a form of ingratitude.
Mm-hmm.
Look at all that they did for us, so that we could have the advantages and the opportunities that we have that they never had, never enjoyed, but they worked to attain it so we would have it, and we do.
And so dangerous for them. They put their lives on the line.
Oh, absolutely. If you signed your name to the Declaration of Independence, you were signing your death warrant because you were committing treason. And if you were captured, you would be hanged. You would be killed or shot or some form of it. And it was no easy thing.
Hmm. You wrote, one of the speeches is about historic places, and you have us imagine if there were no historical places in this country, and you're so inspired by places you've seen. It reminded me of that speech, because I believe you wrote in the book that the Adams House is still standing, the place where Abigail spent so much time by herself doing absolutely everything. Can you see that? I didn't know that.
Oh, absolutely. It's open to the public. It's fantastic.
I have to go.
Not only that, the house that he was born in is still there, and the house that he moved into when he and Abigail were first married is still there. So there are three original houses, furnished, that are still there. And you can look at this, the room where their daughter suffered a mastectomy right there in the house, and they had to stand outside the door and imagine the suffering that was going on. This is way before anesthetics were available. And you can see where he wrote his letters and where he walked his walk in the garden and all of that. It's marvelous that they're still there.
Yes, it is. I'll have to go there. Let's go to phone calls, more of them. Tom is next. Hello, Tom.
Mrs. Dunn, Mr. McCullough, it's a great honor. I appreciate you taking my call.
Thank you.
You know, like a good speech, you got to be able to focus and stay direct and to the point. Just like with your writing, how do you differentiate what you consider important for the book, or as, and just like with these speeches, when you review a great speech, how do you stay focused and in lines of the thought and be able to edit out what you consider important for this? Because, you know, you have so much great information that you could talk about it all day, and it'd be its own other book or speech, just like the singing. How do you stay focused on that?
Well, of course, you're talking about two different forms. The speech is a different form from the printed page. But I have always written for the ear as well as for the eye. In other words, and most of the greats of the past have done that, which is what inspired me to do it. So I have my wife, bless her heart, read what I have written after I feel it's in good shape. And you hear things that you don't see, particularly if you're looking at these same pages day after day. And you can hear when you're repeating a word too often, or a phrase, or the structure of a sentence. And most importantly, you can hear when you're being boring. And that's not allowed. Because people have much more to do, quite rightly, if they wish, than to read your book or to listen to your speech. So in many ways, I don't consider, though they are different forms, I don't consider the process all that different. With a speech, of course, particularly if you want to be kind and thoughtful to people, you have to keep it relatively short. The main thing that I've felt is if I'm invited to give a commencement speech, say, at a university or college, complimenting me with in a way that is admirable and important to me.
Mm-hmm.
So I will never just get up and wing it, just get up and do something that will be passing. I really work on it. So a speech may only last 20 minutes, but I may have worked a full week on it. And a lot of it is cutting it down, reducing it, keeping it to its essentials. And I've always felt you have to have a character or two about whom you're talking. People are interested most of all in people.
Mm-hmm. It's hard, though. It must be doubly hard for you. I think speeches are very hard to write. But you also have this incredible breadth of historical knowledge so that you could tell, you know, 500 stories in each one of those speeches, and you could weave us through the Revolution and the Civil War and you know, the 1960s. You could go from time to time to time. It must be hard to take all that's in your mind and make it 20 minutes.
Well, it is and it isn't. I've been doing it a long time, and that helps. It helps immensely. I also I grew up in a family with a lot of talkers. And I think it's our Irish background. Mm-hmm. Has something to do with it. Maybe it has a lot to do with it. But I liked to address people. I liked to be in front of an audience and talk to the audience because I don't see it as a big force there. I have to have the house lights up a little bit so I can see the faces. I couldn't do it in front of a blank wall.
Mm-hmm.
And when I've narrated films for Ken Burns and others, and that's very hard for me because I'm not seeing anything. I'm locked in a little studio. Well, you know very well from your
Yes, I'm there right now.
And that took quite a while to get used to, but I think I've got the hang of it now.
And you've spoken in all 50 states. You're still at it because this is very true. You say you have something to say. And you do, and you like to see people, and you like to listen to them.
I do. I love it. And my interest in history really began with a high school age visit to Monticello
mm-hmm.
When I was 15. And I suddenly thought, whoa, this is amazing. And I loved the house. I loved the furnishings. I loved the story. I loved hearing about his accomplishments and so his interests. And I just this weekend spoke at Monticello.
Oh, did you?
Yes,
oh.
I did. So it was a wonderful full swing of the arc to come back again and give a speech there.
You've also been at places where because you lived through some of these times, it must be a well of emotions that you have to tuck away for a while. You also spoke in Dallas at the 50th.
Yes.
I can't believe it's been 50 years. Well,
yeah,
it's more than that now.
That was the hardest event for me to take part in ever because, well, I was on the New Frontier. I was in the Kennedy administration. I was in a very unpublicized and relatively unimportant role, but I was still there. I was working as an editor with the U.S. Information Agency.
Oh.
I had been working at Time and Life in New York and for about 6 years.
Mm-hmm.
And when Kennedy called on us to do something for our country, not just wait for our country to do something for us, I took it to heart. I quit my job and went down and looked for a job in Washington and wound up doing that at the time when Edward R. Murrow was running the USIA.
Oh.
So it was a very exciting time then.
Yes.
And when the day he was killed was easily the worst day of my life up until then. So to stand at the place where he was killed
right.
and deliver a talk in front of 5,000 people who were standing in the rain,
mm-hmm.
and they'd been standing there in a cold rain, standing there for 4 hours. And that in itself was touching in the extreme. But I got through it, and I'm very proud of the fact that I was asked to do it. And I hope it conveys to the younger generation what a hold he had on our patriotism, our dedication to serving the country.
And on our careers, I can't tell you how many people I've interviewed who've been governors or political offices who served
Absolutely.
In the Peace Corps. They served in the Peace Corps because of him or in VISTA,
but,
you know?
But and isn't it sad, truly, that in the 50-some years since then, not one president has called on us to do something for our country.
You're right. Let's go back to phone calls. David McCullough is our guest. We're so happy to have him with us this hour, and he's the author now of a selection of 25 speeches he's given over the past 25 years, very important speeches on a variety of topics in which we all learn a great deal more about history, people we should know better, people who he has helped us to understand much more, Harry Truman and certainly John Adams and John Quincy Adams. The book is The American Spirit, Who We Are and What We Stand For. 800-486-8655 is the number. Connie in Portage is our next caller, David. Hi, Connie.
Hi. You have no idea how happy I am to listen to this show. I bought that series, DVD, and I watch it at least 3 times a year.
Oh, my.
It's probably the best one I've ever seen, and I love Laura Linney. And was it Paul Giamatti?
Yes, Paul Giamatti.
I said Frank, that mistake.
Yes,
Paul.
I think it was Paul.
And a wonderful man.
Oh, and I learned so much visually, and so with my history, you know, it just helped me so much, and it's the best one I've ever seen, and I'm just so happy to hear you talking about it.
Thank you.
Yeah, just wanted
very,
to let you know
very
that.
Very much. Yeah,
yeah,
thank
you very much. Well, I hate to be bringing us up to the current moment, but I feel like I need to, with you particularly, because I'm sure you have thoughts on this. You talk about Kennedy, who read history, who wrote history, who knew words matter. We've had a lot of other presidents, of course, who have a great sense of history and who have invited historians to come to the Oval Office and talk about history. We do have a president now who seems to have problems with the Civil War when Andrew Jackson lived, Frederick Douglass, who doesn't seem to have a strong grasp of history. And I'm wondering what you think about that. Is it important for a president to have a strong sense of history? And then the other question that I must ask you, because we're having this interview today, you have written Nothing Happens in a Vacuum, Actions Have Consequences, and I would like for you to comment on the action taken by President Trump to fire the director of the FBI, James Comey, which has people were saying on TV, this is historic, this is historic. Is it, and what about having a president who just doesn't have a strong sense of history?
Well, I think it's most unfortunate. I think it's an ominous indication of what may lie ahead. History is about cause and effect. It's about how actions have consequences and inactions have consequences. And yes, most of our, in fact, all of our finest, most effective and successful presidents have had a strong sense of history and a strong knowledge of history. And to have one now who, in an interview with the Washington Post, when asked if he had ever read a presidential biography, said no. When asked if he'd ever read a book about the presidency, he said no. Mm. When asked if he had any intention to do so, he said maybe. But then went on to say that he had such a mind that he didn't need books or reading books. Well, I think that's preposterous, and I think it could be dangerous, and I think it's most unfortunate. But I think what we need to do is restore the long-standing respect for the importance of history in our country and in our education. We've been raising several generations of young Americans who are, by and large, historically illiterate. And it's not their fault. It's our fault, and we need to correct it. As for the recent developments of the last 48 hours or whatever it is, I think they could have very profound consequences. Certainly it did back in the time of Nixon, and we just don't know what more there is going to be uncovered or what more is going to be divulged by those who go before Senate committees to testify, and it's all going to be unfolding pretty rapidly. I don't know any more than any of us know what's going to come out. Mm-hmm. And we have to remember that nobody in the past ever knew how it was going to come out any
exactly.
more than we do.
No, exactly.
And we need to, it's history is so often taught as if it was all on a track, and there was this happened, that happened, that happened. This man came in, or this man went out, and as if it was all preordained or written down on a schedule. No, they never knew any more than we do, and they never knew any more than we do how they were going to be recorded in time to come. They just were doing the best they could at the time. And I think that one of the most fortunate, we should be paying more attention, and I say we, those of us that write history and teach history, paying more attention to two things. One is thinking. How did they think? When did they think? How much did they think? One of the most striking entries, and my favorite entry, in the many diaries that John Adams kept, is that there'd be every so often, the only entry for that day would be at home thinking. Now imagine if we had people in public life who would record that as the at home thinking. People ask me, how much of my time do I spend doing research and how much of my time do I spend writing? Perfectly good question. No one's ever asked me, how much of your time do you spend thinking? And, of course, the thinking is a huge part of it.
Right.
And it helps to in our thinking, if we can refer to examples or performances of admirable quality of character to guide us in our thinking. That's why history is so important. And I feel, too, very strongly, that history, the knowledge of history, is invigorating. It leads to, in my own case, I know, to optimism, that things will come out for the better. It may not be easy. It may not be painless. But we've always had problems. We've always had trouble. We've always had tragedies. But in the long run, it works out. The ship writes itself. Hmm. And I also feel that history is a wonderful antidote to the hubris of the present. This sense that, oh, we're the niftiest, most wonderful people that ever were, and nobody's ever been like us. Nonsense. Absolute nonsense. I remember standing in front of the great painting, The Birth of Venus, in the Uffizi Gallery in Florence, and thinking, oh, my goodness, who in the world today could do anything like that? Well, the answer is nobody. So if we want to see how it's really done, as it were, we start looking at how it was done before us. One of the biggest strokes of luck that ever happened to us, and luck plays as much part in history as it does in our individual lives, was that George Washington was our leader, not just in the war and in the presidency, but all through eight years of war, 8 years as president, 16 years, and a man of absolute integrity, strength of character, perseverance, and spirit, and who took his responsibilities with the utmost seriousness and knew when to step down, knew when to say, that's enough, I'm going back to my life, and set thereby an example that we wouldn't be putting potential kings in the royal chair.
And now you have me thinking about thinking, because think of all those people, all the founders, Thomas Jefferson, Benjamin Franklin, for heaven's sake.
Think of the thinking they did.
They were all thinkers, weren't they?
Absolutely. Hmm. And in a tiny population, out of a tiny population, our whole population, only 2,500,000 people, and 500,000 of those 2,500,000 were held in bondage. They were slaves.
Wow. We'll take more phone calls in a moment. David McCullough is our guest this hour. His latest book is The American Spirit, Who We Are and What We Stand For. David is a highly decorated historian. He is the author of so many books. The Wright Brothers, his most recent, which was a New York Times bestseller. His great book about John Adams and Abigail and the whole lot. His book about Harry Truman, which I loved as well, and many other books. And we're delighted to have him with us this hour. 800-486-8655 is our number. We'll take more phone calls in a moment here on the Ideas Network. Back to phone calls for David McCullough. We go to Kenneth in Janesville. Hi, Kenneth.
Hello.
Hi.
I don't mean to be impertinent. I really want to know, why did you write the book?
Which book?
Your last one.
Oh, I didn't write it. I gave it as speeches over 25 years. It's a collection of my work. It's as if I were a painter, had been painting for 25 years, and I'd never shown my paintings, so I wanted to have an exhibit. So these are the speeches that I feel express what I deeply feel about our country and the importance of our values as they've come down to us from beginnings, and the how I feel about who we are and what we are obliged to keep going and improve, and the people that I have come to know in my work, many of whom I've felt and still feel I know better than I know people in real life. Because for one thing, in real life, you don't get to read other people's mail. And when you're doing research, particularly on historic figures who lived in an age when they wrote letters all the time, and even often more revealing, diaries, it's a rich, fertile ground to plow and explore. Mm.
Thanks, Kenneth, for your call. One more phone call. Jerry in Wausau. Hi.
Yes, I have one kind of minor complaint, Mr. McCullough. A couple of winters ago, when it was really cold weather in February, I went to the library. I needed a big book, and I checked out Harry Truman, thinking I'd have, 10 days, at least 2 weeks of reading. I started it on Tuesday night and finished it Thursday. It was so good. The backhanded compliment in a way, but that was a wonderful book because earlier in the program you mentioned how you like to write about people that aren't the most famous in the world, and that was a wonderful book. Thank you very much. I was at Monticello, and it was my second time there. I spent the whole day. I'd go back again next week if I lived out there.
Hmm. Well, wonderful. I had a neighbor who was on in years, and he said that he would like very much to read my Truman book, but he was afraid that he might fall asleep in bed and it would crush his chest. When I finished the book and turned it in to my editor at Simon & Schuster, I said I was concerned that it was too long. And he said, no, it's not too long. It's a big life, a big subject, and an important figure in our story as a country. And he didn't want me to cut or change a word. So I'm ever grateful that he had that point of view.
So are you taking on somebody else? Are you going to talk about write about Margaret Chase Smith or Georgia?
No, I'm writing about the establishment of the Northwest Territory.
Oh.
The territory of part of your territory. The states that comprised that empire of wilderness were Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, Michigan, and Wisconsin.
Great.
And it's one of the great stories of our whole history. And I found this fabulous, wonderful collection of original diaries and letters by the pioneers who went out and settled in the first settlement in the entire territory at Marietta, Ohio. Yeah. And they were in the archival collection at Marietta College. And I'm thrilled about it. I've always wanted to do a book about people you never heard of.
Yes, I know. Speeches.
They're all characters who've not figured in history books, or if they did, in a marginal fashion. And they really are extraordinary.
There are many extraordinary who came before us. Well, David, thank you. It was a real treat to talk to you. And what a great idea to put together speeches. And they're filled
thank
with
you.
History and... And I could see you there, standing there at these very important occasions, too, just where the speeches that you chose, where you were. That's meaningful as well. It was fun.
Thank you, Kathleen. It's been a privilege to be on your program.
Thank you, David, and what a privilege to have you with us. David McCullough, our guest this hour. The book is The American Spirit, Who We Are and What We Stand For. He is a highly honored historian. He's been called the master of the art of narrative history. And I'm so glad that several of you called who were just absorbed by his books, the Truman book, and, of course, the book about John Adams and the documentary, the Ken Burns documentary. It was fabulous. If you haven't seen it, it's a 7-part series, and Paul Giamatti and Lynn is, what's her first name? The actress, marvelous, absolutely wonderful performances. You'll watch one after another. You can binge watch John Adams. Laura Lynn. That's her name, right? Well, that was fun. David has won 2 National Book Awards and 2 Pulitzer Prizes and has made a huge contribution to our understanding and knowing more about this country, America. Thanks so much to Marika Saval for producing this hour. Thank you, Marika, very much. Thanks to Colleen Leahy for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. And thanks for your calls, for listening, everybody. We are going to be with you again tomorrow. Again, we'll be looking this hour at Janesville tomorrow and a couple people who are featured in this book, Janesville, An American Story. It should be a really good hour. And I hope you will listen to it as well as the first hour tomorrow, which will be on the firing of Jim Comey. This is the Ideas Network.